let's use the analogy of the dreamer's mind and the dreamed character in the dreamed world. Yes?
With a reverent bow to the wow, this is once again Lama Love Mutt. I've been lurking around in the halls and in the backyard for a while, but I'm here today on March 1st to add a commentary in the installment on cosmic projection, which comes with the Dragonfly Sutra. It's been a while since I've been able to get back to the subject of cosmic projection, and I do want to bring that matter to closure if I can. As you know by now, cosmic projection carries with it the imperative discernment between what happens in the world event, theater side, and what happens booth side. So I've introduced the analogy of a hologram in parallel to the tantric scheme of the 36 tattvas, and that is the main topic of this section on cosmic projection. But just today, it so happens that something came up in the suggestions for YouTube vids, and it happens to be an Advaita guru, rather like David Sparrow, and with a similar last name, Rupert Spira. Now, I've never heard of Rupert Spira before. Apparently, he's been around for at least 10 years and has quite a following on the internet and does seminars here and there around Europe. He's of British origin, English. He was a potter, perhaps he still is, and he was associated at one point with Kathleen Raine, the well-known scholar and expert on William Blake. So I met Kathleen Raine in London. I think it was in 1992, in her house in Chelsea. So that places me directly beside Rupert Spira, in a way, connected by one degree of separation. Kathleen Raine is no longer alive. And he was born in 1960, so he's 15 years younger than me. Anyway, you can read some of his biographical details there. It's taken from the Amazon.com profile. And you'll note that he has been involved since the age of 17 in a mixed bag of studies and practices involving classical Advaita Vedanta and also Kashmir Shaivism, which, as I've said, is pretty much the Siamese twin of Hindu Tantra and likewise of planetary Tantra. So I'm including this little commentary for you to follow upon listening to that 12-minute vid. And I've given some time signatures indicating specific things that he has said, which I am quoting here in the text for this unit. So at first sight, it appears that Rupert Spira might be positioned to offer non-attainment teachings in some respects. In another talk entitled, "Is the Direct Path Appropriate for Everyone?" he says, quote, "I don't want to become a Buddha. Buddha is just another name for the nature of our being. How do we become that?" End quote. Now, you'll notice in this assertion, Buddha is just another name for the nature of our being that Spira uses syntax which occurs endlessly and repetitively in Dzogchen teachings as well. One of the most repeated tropes, or memes you could say, of Dzogchen is the nature of mind. The nature of mind. I believe that the use of this expression goes back to D.T. Suzuki, the Japanese Zen master, who was more or less responsible for coming to the West and introducing Zen Buddhism to the West. He was a spiritual icon in the 60s, the era of Gary Snyder and Alan Watts, who took up Buddhism and integrated it into their way of life and represented it to the Western world and to my generation at that time. The nature of mind is a phrase that you find repeated hundreds and hundreds of times. Now, I haven't yet directly commented on that phrase, but in view of future commentary I might make, I can say this right now. What is the use? What is the benefit? And what is the outcome of realizing the nature of mind if you don't realize the mind of nature? ? I strongly object. Lama Lovemut strongly objects. Put it on record to this meme, the nature of mind. And I've been contemplating a single talk dedicated to setting out my objections to that terminology, to that façon de parler, that manner of speaking. So it strikes me that at the first moment he comes up on the screen, I see that Rupert Spira is comfortable with that delivery. He is confident and comfortable, it would appear, in repeating that cliche, which is all that it is, call it a trope, call it a meme, fancify it as you will. It's merely a cliche. The nature of our being, in his delivery, refers to the infinite source of consciousness and the infinite consciousness, the Godhead, and so forth, as we'll see in my short commentary on his talk. But I can guarantee you, or no, I'll put it in another way, until I see evidence to the contrary, I'm proceeding on the assumption, my humble opinion, woof woof, that Advaitic discourse on the nature of our being and the ultimate nature of reality totally excludes any consideration of nature, of the natural world, of the intelligence of the natural world, the matrix of Mother Earth. But of course, you know that already, don't you? So, Tathagata, moving on, let's take a look at some of the things that Rupert Spira says in this 12-minute talk. His response to the question posed by the Dutch-speaking participant, who obviously has some difficulty articulating himself in English, begins at 2 minutes and 30 seconds with the line that I've recorded at the beginning of this talk. Spira proposes, quote, "Let's use the analogy of the dreamer's mind and the dreamed character," end quote. Well, how about that? Gee whiz, what a novel idea. Who would ever have thought of such an analogy? Who in the world would ever have come up with such a line as that? The analogy of the dreamer's mind and the dreamed character. And then he proceeds to discourse on the dreamed character. And he says, essentially, that the dreamed character is not a problem except when it takes itself for a separate and permanent entity. Now, this discourse coming from Spira demonstrates the traditional line of Vedic deconstruction of the permanent ego self, anattam, the no-self doctrine, which has a parallel but also divergent development in Buddhism. So the Vedic Vedantic teachers' discourse on the problem of the dreamed character, or more specifically, the illusion of the permanent individual self attached to the dream character in one way. And Buddhists and Mahayanists and Dzogchen masters discourse upon it in another way. And as that discourse proceeds, of course, both parties on the Vedic side, booth side, and on the Buddhist, in the Buddhist camp, theater side, ultimately have to come around and make some assertion about the dreamer's mind, or the, quote, nature of mind, end quote. That is to say, the ultimate ground of consciousness, of which what you experience as mind is one manifestation, the human mind, and your personal mind. So they all ultimately have to come around to talking about source. Now, what is Spira going to say about source? Well, I don't know, because I've only listened to two of his talks, and I don't intend to make a huge investigation of what he's saying. But you can be pretty sure, I'm guessing, that when he talks about the infinite consciousness, as he does in this little excerpt, he's not going to be presenting a paradigm or a conceptual syntax that refers specifically to the intelligence of the living earth. He's going to refer back, as all Vedic and Advaita Vedantic teachers do, to Parasamvit in Western theology, the Godhead, in metaphysical or abstract terms, the Absolute, or the ground, or the urground, or the ungrund, as Jakob Burmi called it. Many names for it. But it's not the ground you're standing on, is it? So that's the difference between what these representatives of these traditions have to say and what Lama Lovemud has to say. Now, you'll see that at various points in this talk, Spira uses the term bundle. Well, that's a direct translation. In fact, it's a literal translation of the Sanskrit word skanda. Now, the Mahayanists are constantly talking about the skandhas. And when you look at the model of the 36 tattvas, which I have right here in front of me, you can locate the skandhas in that model. They are named according to the five elements: earth, air, water, fire, and akasha. And they are also characterized more expansively according to the faculties known as the jnanendriyas, hearing, touch, sight, taste, and smell, and other capacities for action known as the karmendriyas. And all in all, there's a total of 18 components proceeding from the lens, which itself protrudes from the projection booth. So all in all, in the grand scheme of the 36 tattvas, half of them, 18, belong to the theater side, and that's also where the skandhas are located. The 17th tattva, proceeding from number 1, the light and power source, Parasamvit, is manas, which is, by analogy, the lens of the cosmic projector. So the grand scheme of the tattvas is a wonderful instructive device in sorting out how consciousness works. And I'm convinced that there is pretty much nothing that cannot be explained by way of this illustrative scheme. The shema, I like that word, of the 36 tattvas is quite a delightful piece of intel, if I do say so myself. So Spira uses that word, skanda, bundle, which has been in use for centuries, both in the Vedic and Buddhic traditions. The skandhas are the components of the projected display of the cosmic event, including the human witness, as it operates on the theater side. The infinite consciousness of which Spira speaks is the light source, light and power source, on the booth side. Now, here, as often happens, the clash between Buddhist and Vedic metaphysics, or paraphysics, as I prefer to call it, noetics, really, comes to attention. These two schools deconstruct the fictional entity of the self-conscious self, the dreamed actor, in different ways. And there is one talk in which Ken Wheeler clarifies this point brilliantly. He cites the concept of anatta, or no self, in Buddhism, and he points out that from the view perspective of the original Buddhism in the Pali canon to which he adheres, the Buddhist and Mahayanist and Dzogchen concept of anatta is an error which ignores and denies the higher self or divine self, the Atman, identical with the Godhead, which is positioned booth side. So to put it fast and simple, the Buddhist discourse of all the schools, except apparently the Hinayana, treat the situation as if consciousness originates in the 17th tattva, manas, and they completely ignore the operations of consciousness, booth side. But Spira, in his way, and Ken Wheeler, in his way, point back to what is happening booth side. Isn't it wonderful to discern the difference in these traditions of discourse and deconstruction? It makes you a Vidyadhara. You hold in your hand that Vajra thunderbolt, that tool of tantric power composed of silver and gold. So, consistent with his analogy of the dreamed character and what he calls the dreamer's mind, Spira says that, quote, the soul reality is the knowing of the dreamer's mind, end quote. The soul reality is the knowing of the dreamer's mind, this being presumably the source of the self-awareness of the dreamed character, as well as the source of everything else, the world in which the dreamed character appears, the world event as a whole, presumably. Now, consistent with Vedantic teaching, this knowing of the ultimate source of reality belongs to and emanates from, quote, the infinite consciousness, end quote. What Spira is saying here is the perennial truth of Advaita Vedanta. It's the foundational premise of the whole enchilada, as well, in another sense, of the whole nine yanas, although the Buddhists look to that source and refer to that source in a different way. So, the assumption or the conclusion follows, and this is a very big deal for a conclusion, I advise you to suspend your belief in this conclusion, to bring your faculty of probity to this conclusion, which is that the manifestation of this ultimate reality in its localization in the dreamed character is not real and produces suffering. Bingo! Let me clarify, just for a moment. Let me paraphrase. Doing my level best to paraphrase accurately and not present a straw man argument. The perennial Vedantic teaching says that the localization, I'm using Spira's term, the localization of the infinite source consciousness in this self-awareness of the dreamed character results in a state of unreality. It is not real compared to the source from which it proceeds. And due to the fact that it is not real, it incurs suffering. So that is the explanation in a nutshell from the Vedantic point of view of why human beings suffer. And of course, the complaint about suffering is a very big deal in Vedantic metaphysics and in Advaita Vedanta, as it is in Buddhism. As far as I can tell, you find as much pissing and moaning and endless whining about suffering in the Asian wisdom schools as you find among the Jews. As a matter of fact, all of those systems, the worldview of the Zenosh and the paradigms of cosmic awareness from the Asian schools share that one element in common. They're all constantly moaning about how much they suffer. The only difference is that with the Jews, with the racial Zenosh, they take it very personally, and they think that they are the exclusive recipients of suffering above and beyond what anyone else, any of the other dreamed characters, might have to endure as suffering. But suffering is the ground theme, the plea of these religious systems, as well as the imperative or dominant obsession of the Zenosh mindset, is suffering. Suffer, suffer, suffer. Oh, how terrible. Life is nothing but suffering. And who knows, Jew knows, who suffers the most. And it is really tiring to hear this protest ring through the ages. It's tiresome and tedious and boring. And also, it happens to be so prevalent that it drowns out another voice. It drowns out another message. This is a slight digression here, but I can't let this commentary go by without pointing this out. Kama Kala Vilasa is the name of a Hindu tantric text in the tradition of the Kalikas, that is to say, of the erotic and sensual mysticism of the East. Kama Kala Vilasa has in it the word vilasa, as in Vajra Vilasi, vilasa meaning flirtation, some outrageous behavior that attracts, like outrageous beauty. And kama means desire. So there is another voice which tends to get drowned out beneath the chorus of kvetching and whining about suffering. Another voice that says, hey, it's all about desire and pleasure. Bhoga, pleasure. It's all about desire and pleasure. And in the Kalika schools of hedonic mysticism, I guess you could call it that, couldn't you? In the perspective of hedonic mysticism, you have this play on words in Sanskrit, bhoga, meaning pleasure or enjoyment, and bhaga, which refers to the female organs of generation, which is also the organs, which are also organs of pleasure, and may be primarily considered as organs of pleasure and only secondarily as organs of procreation. So the bhaga, literally female genitalia, the vulva, the orifice between a woman's legs, also alludes to matrix. So bhaga is matrix, and according to this Kalika hedonism, the matrix or source of everything that manifests is kama, desire, and it is the desire for pleasure and the pleasure of desiring that produces the manifest worlds. Well, you don't hear that message very often, do you? It gets drowned out by this enormous chorus of moaning and whining about suffering. So anyway, that was a digression. May it come over as an instructive one worthy of your time. Now, to return to this basic conclusion, talking about the conclusion of Vedantic of the Vedantic syntax that describes, actually, paradoxically, a duality. You know, Advaita is supposed to be the system of unity, ad meaning non, and veta meaning divided or split. So Advaita literally means a non-split, right? So what Advaita teaches is that the awareness that you have now, which you mistake for your personal or individual mind, is actually identical with the source awareness of infinite consciousness, and that is Advaita. The two are not separate. The two are a unity. Nevertheless, you can see in Spira's language that the assertion of that unity is posited on a duality. And what is the duality? Well, it's the duality of the non-real and the real. That is what it is in Vedantic terms. In Buddhism, it's the duality of the permanent and the impermanent. So, in Vedic terms, according to the syntax of Spira, the localization of the infinite consciousness in the self-awareness of the dreamed character, when it takes itself for an entity, is not real, because as an entity, it is not real. It does not exist. And that unreality, that state of unreality and the conditions that arise due to it, produce suffering. And that state of unreality of the dreamed character is contrasted to the ultimate reality of the infinite consciousness. So can you see that it takes two to know one, as I said many years ago? It takes two to know one. The syntax is unavoidable. Mayavada Vedanta, which consciously uses descriptive duality in the syntax, is superior to the metaphysics of Advaita because it knows that the language it uses must come through duality no matter where it wants to go. Whereas Advaita posits the non-dual by using the contrast of a fundamental and absolute dualistic proposition, real versus non-real. Now I'm going to concentrate on that. And I'm going to spin it around and spin it back to you in the form of a question. Why can't they both be real? Why can't both the infinite ground source consciousness, the dreamer's mind, according to Spira, and the self-awareness of the dreamed character and the dream character itself both be real? Why does it have to be a contest? One is real and the other is unreal, non-real. You must avoid the non-real, transcend the non-real, decondition yourself out of thinking in terms of the non-real concept of an independent entity who thinks, and in doing so, so they claim, you come to the realization of the real, bingo. And then from that realization, tat vamasi, thou art that, you then experience the actions and the thinking, perceiving, and sensing of the dreamed character in an altered way, because you are experiencing it from the Advaita perspective of non-duality. All right, fair enough. But I'm sensing that one further nuance of clarification could be provided here. I'm proposing that the world event experienced by the dreamed character is just as real as the infinite ground consciousness which produces it. But in making that assertion, and I'm going to go deeper into it in a moment, in making that assertion, I'd like to point out that I agree, yes, there is one factor, there is one component in the awareness of the dream character that is not real, and that is the sense of separation. You know, I've said before, and you can quote me on this, separation is an illusion, but difference is real. So I would agree that the sense of separation of the dreamed character who, for instance, assumes that he or she is thinking, is an entity thinking their own thoughts, I agree that that concept of self, which I would call the reflex self, which is a component of the operations of mind, that concept of self is illusory. It is an illusion. But that illusion is situated in the entire field of the experience of the dreamed character in a particular way that needs to be seen for what it is and appreciated and enjoyed, and also needs to be, what is the word I'm looking for, regarded with sobriety and suspicion in some respects. But the fact that the sense of individual selfhood, I am an entity thinking my own thoughts, is an illusion, is one thing. What does it say about the illusory character of the entire field of experience of the dreamed character? Nothing at all. The entire field of experience of the dreamed character is not an illusion. The illusion is in the sense of separation that arises by association with that self-reflex, which is just a thought, the thought of self, the thought of ego, of individual personhood. But the entire range and scope and depth of experiences of the dreamed character is not illusion. It's not an illusion. Why can't it be real, just as real as the infinite and ultimate ground source upon which it stands? Why can't they both be real? Why does it have to be a competitive setup, like a zero-sum game in which someone wins and someone loses? Why? So with that question, you can hover like a dragonfly and flutter and dart around in the space of Lama Lovemut's refutation of Vedic and Vedantic teachings, Vedic and Vedantic philosophy of the self. That's one game of refutation. Remember, in Kali Yuga, enlightenment is nothing but a game of pretenses. And whoever has the most transparent pretenses wins the game. So you can play that game in one way by refuting Vedantic philosophy. You can play it in another way by refuting Buddhist philosophy. I would have to dedicate a separate commentary to that. But I can give you a short preview. The cliche constantly repeated in Buddhist philosophy is that you suffer because everything is impermanent. Well, first of all, I question the validity of that statement on its own terms. But let's just say that's true. You suffer due to the fact that even the greatest pleasure is impermanent. It comes and it goes. But I ask you, impermanent compared to what? How can you even know it's impermanent if you don't have a state of permanence to compare it to? And how do you experience a state of permanence? And what if it turns out, you ready for this, that samsara is not an illusion? Samsara and this enlightenment have the same look. And it may well be that permanence is the illusion. Anyway, further reflections on that notion would belong to a specific refutation of Buddhist philosophy. And I'm not going there right now. Bring this commentary on the short talk of Rupert Spira to its conclusion. I direct your attention to the image of the severed rose. Severed Rose is the title of a kind of autobiography that I've cobbled together over the years, which ideally would come out, would appear in the world as a printed book from Terma Publishing, along with a CD of some interviews relevant to the contents of that presumed autobiography. Severed Rose is the title of the story of my life. But what is my life? Well, my life is a series of events in the experience of one dreamed character in the dreamer's mind. Whoever the dreamer may be. And my life story is just like any other story. The life story, the literal life story, an account of the events of your life or mine, is no different from a work of fiction, a good work of fiction, or what John Gardner, a brilliant renegade American novelist, called moral fiction. If the story of my life is moral fiction, as fictional works of great literature are moral fiction, then the story has to have a moral. It's been a long time, my friends, since that notion was obliterated. But a story has a moral. It has a takeaway. It's not just the meaning of the story, but it's the moral. What is the moral of Severed Rose? Well, you could put it like this. Between two aspects of a single and supreme reality, the presence of what's now becoming, there must be a severance, a rendering into duality, which carries the risk of loss and suffering, so that the two can be consciously reunited at the level of the transcendent witness, the human animal living on earth. That's one way of putting it. To borrow from Spira's syntax, you could put it in this way. each and every dreamed character has a mission, which is different according to the parameters of experience and the conditions of the life of that character. The differences are real. And at the same time, each and every dreamed character has the same mission. The same mission. What that mission is comes to attention and definition by looking at the factor of separation. Now, Vedic philosophy asserts that you transcend the separation of the illusory sense of an individual self by identification with the divine self, the ultimate self, the Atman. While in Planetary Tantra and Mayavada Vedanta, strangely enough, even though Mayavada Vedanta is dualistic, the proposition of the two selves is utterly rejected. There are not two selves in Mayavada Vedanta or PT, nor in Dog Zen. In Dog Zen, you have what I've called the self-reflex, or the reflex self, which is a production of the mind, and you have the species self. That's the dog in Dog Zen, the species self, not the ultimate self of Mayavada Vedanta, but the identity of the species self. Every dreamed character originates from the same species self. Therefore, the sense or the illusory sense of separation is transcended and overcome by recognition of the species self. Do you see how beautiful this is? Do you see how this proposition works? And yet at the same time, yep, at the very same time, as I just noted, the mission of the dream character is to reunite what has been severed. But if it had never been severed, you wouldn't have a mission, would you? How fortunate that the rose was severed. And the moral of that story is, all dream characters have the same mission in common, yet they all have different destinies, different fates, and different expressions of the ultimate endowment of the species to which they belong. So in conclusion, well, I'll leave you to draw your own conclusion. It might occur to you in the course of listening to these words and reflecting on them that there's a program of dissociation in Vedantic and Buddhist teachings. In fact, Spira clearly says in that short talk that the way the program of self-realization works, according to him, according to his mystical realization, is that you disidentify from the body and from the illusion of what I have called the single self identity. But what actually does this disidentification entail? Well, in Buddhist terms, as Ken Wheeler points out from the perspective of the Pali Canon, you are not the skandhas, you are not the bundles, but you are still there. By contrast, Dzogchen would say, yes, you are not the skandhas, you are not the bundles of thinking, perceiving, and sensing. And you are not even there. The only thing that is there is a non-entified witness, the ground of witnessing itself. Rigpa, you see? But I leave you with a question. Why would you disidentify and dissociate yourself in that way if it's not really necessary? If it's not necessary, if you have an option. And what is the option? Well, you know what the option is. To see your source in the material presence of the world event where you, the dreamed character, live and move. To see your source and know your source where it is. And not to suppose or presume or imagine that it is anywhere else in some abstract, disembodied realm of the absolute Godhead. Planetary Tantra gloriously offers you that option, but the offer comes to you along with the moral of the story of Severed Rose. If the original unity had not been severed, you wouldn't have a mission in this life. The dream character would be without its common and transcendent purpose. I don't know. I'm just guessing, and I'm really not in a position to judge. But I have to wonder if anything in the Vedic and Buddhist teachings as they survive today comes anywhere close to what I'm talking about. It's not up to Lama Lovemut to make that call. And all he can do is remind you that whatever comes across to you in these words depends not on where it takes you, but on where you take it. Where you take it.